The topic for this discussion is derived from my rereading of a book that's titled The Heart of the Bodhi Tree by a Thai meditation master named Buddhadasa. He's no longer alive, but this book is meant to explain the Buddhist concept of sunyata, which is usually translated as emptiness. I really was impressed by my rereading of the book, and I think it's because my practice has gotten to the point now where I get a lot more out of what I read before. Particularly, I'm interested in these days in this Buddhist concept, sunyata. Another way it's described is anatta, the absence of an enduring autonomous self. The traditional rendering of sunyata is emptiness, and anatta is non-self. That seems very mysterious, kind of out there somewhere. You really don't understand what it means. But my background in meditation and my training as a mental health professional helped me to kind of understand how to relate to this concept from a Western kind of scientific perspective. I think it's pretty rich. So I was inspired to actually transcribe a an excerpt, a couple of pages out of the book. And I'm going to read that off in a few minutes. And then I want to open the floor for questions or comments. Everybody here in the room has a paper copy. Not everyone, almost everyone in the room has a paper copy and can be referred to while I'm reading it or afterwards if you have questions. And it will be part of the hosting later this week of this recording and the notes I prepared that I'm looking at right now on my computer. So you'll have access to it for further study and contemplation. Another thing that's been interesting for me about life these days is this phenomenon we call ChatGPT. I actually started using it. I used it for the Dharma talk notes last week and used it again tonight. And I can tell you, I am an informed reader of what ChatGPT has to say. I might make some slight wording differences, but not really important. So here's a quote from ChatGPT responding to the question, Buddhist voidness. What is Buddhist voidness? So here's what it has to say. Buddhist voidness, also called sunyata, is a core concept in Buddhist philosophy, particularly in Mahayana traditions. It's often translated as emptiness, but that can be misleading if taken to mean nothingness or nihilism. What does it mean? Voidness refers to the idea that all phenomena are empty of inherent independent existence. Things do not exist as isolated, self-sufficient entities. Instead, they arise through dependent origination, paticca-samuppada, causes and conditions. For example, tree exists because of soil, water, sunlight, air, and countless other conditions. Remove these and tree ceases to exist. The tree does not have a fixed independent essence. Now, I'm going to interject a comment in here and say this notion of what tree is only exists in the mind. Whatever's out there in the world is just what it is, but the mind makes it into a particular thing. In this case, we would call it a tree. So, this, what I just described as an aside, going back to what ChatGPT says, this applies not just to objects, but also to concepts, entities, and even the self. Why is it important? Number one, it breaks attachment. Recognizing voidness loosens our grasping to people, possessions, or ideas as permanent. Number two, reduces suffering. Suffering, dukkha, arises from clinging and aversion. If we see things as fluid and interdependent, relate to them with more equanimity. Three, opens compassion. Understanding that we are deeply interconnected with all beings naturally fosters compassion. There are different perspectives, Buddhist world. Theravada focuses more on non-self, anatta, and impermanence, which is anicca. Sunyata is often about the absence of self. Madhyamaka or Mahayana Buddhism, Nagarjuna developed sunyata philosophically, showing that all things are empty of intrinsic nature. Svabha. Svabhava in Sanskrit. And Zen emphasizes the experiential realization of emptiness as freedom from conceptual thinking. A common misconception: voidness doesn't mean that nothing exists. Rather, it's that things, and this is bolded in the reference from ChatGPT, things don't exist independently or permanently. They're like a rainbow, visible and real, but not solid or self-existence. And here's the final thing that ChatGPT put into the mix. Thich Nhat Hanh put it beautifully. Emptiness is not the absence of something. Emptiness is the presence of everything. Now, I've commented on this many times that we talk about sunyata translated as emptiness, but I think of it as fullness. And maybe I picked that up from reading Thich Nhat Hanh somewhere sometime. I doubt that he picked it up from me. I'm going to read this quote, two-page quote, because it really struck me. The eloquence of it and the clarity of it. So, a few comments before I do that. Realization of the liberating potential that comes with study and practice of the Four Noble Truths involves a quality of emotional discipline and cognitive clarity. So, there's a feeling tone that's well regulated and a mental process, thinking process. We could also call it an emotional process, and they're interactive. So this emotional discipline and cognitive clarity can be best cultivated by a lifestyle of organized around virtue, from the Noble Eightfold Path or the it's right speech, right action, and right livelihood. I've talked about this several times. If you want to go to the website archives on Dharma Talks, you'll find a lot of different recordings that I've made over the years and the notes that posted with them about right speech, right action, and right livelihood. But what I want to emphasize in this context is that, and from a Buddhist perspective, that which is unvirtuous is that which is organized around greed, hatred, and ignorance. And greed, hatred, and ignorance really does not attend to our social, interpersonal, and environmental interactions and responsibilities. So the basic thing is that virtue is pro-social, both interpersonally and in terms of society, culture. It's really important to understand that. This sort of spins off a little bit from the topic of my last talk, empathy and compassion. modality that we all have for empathy is part of this sunyana view, that there's a quality of we vibe off each other instinctively, hardwired for it. And when it's well managed, it's right speech, right action, right livelihood, and there's minimal conflict inside, your conscience is clear, shall we say. Now, that'll be referred to when I read the article. Some things about conscience, having a conscience. Contemporary neuroscientific research reveals a process which is that the let me do a little bit here. Also, I'm being quiet. I'm going to edit this out because I have function in my processor that I use afterwards that can get rid of the sound, but I have to leave some silence in the sound in terms of the for this sound to be picked up and modify the rain sound. Okay. Back out of the weeds. So there's a process that we call neuroplasticity, which is simply stated. This statement goes back to the mid 20th century. Those neurons that fire together wire together. And this is how we experience our own subjectivity, even as I'm speaking for everyone. Neural patterns are activated in the brain. In this case, maybe associated with auditory processes or visual processes. But also, there'll be sensations in your body that you'll be experiencing. So, all of these are being processed through these various neural networks. And the more these networks are reinforced, reenacted, stronger they get. The other part that makes them strong is the degree of emotional potency that might be associated with how the mind is processing the experience. Okay, why do I mention neuroplasticity? Because of the word plasticity. Because when you don't reenact those neural networks, they tend to have a weaker signal strength. They're not quite as convincing in terms of your awareness. That's what neuroplasticity is. And neuroplasticity is one of the contemporary neuroscientific underpinnings for understanding sunyana. So I mentioned earlier that there's this complex interaction going on between environmental stimuli and internal processes. They're always changing. There's a flow of experience. But what Buddhism discovered and what neuroscience is kind of revealing or providing evidence about is that this flow is kind of inherently unstable. Is changing a lot depending on what's going on in your environment externally, but also what's going on in your internal environment. If you're hungry or you're in a mood or you're tired or some kind of disease has affected you, how you're processing it internally is different than how you would process what's going on environmentally. So these are both ways to what I described are ways to understand the whole notion of sunyata. It's not quite so mysterious. We can change our minds. It's one of the things it's from Buddhist teaching. The Buddha said, if I did not know that you could change, I would not teach you. What was he talking about changing? He's talking about the kind of change that overcomes craving and clinging. Craving is a kind of urgent reactivity that we're hardwired into biologically. And clinging is the story, the selfing story that's created that describes our own subjectivity, our ego, let's say, and how the world is. So that's important to understand, that interactive process, how fluid it is and variable it is from person to person and from moment to moment, really. So there's very complex processes going on systematically in our brains and in our bodies. And one of the things that's r really understood, and this very much points to the notion sunyata or anatta, there is no control center. There's no one running the show inside. We tend to experience in our subjectivity, yeah, there's a me in here. And when I walk into the room, friends, they know who I am, right? So on a social level, yes, there is an existence. We have an ego. But spirituality, in this case, Buddhism, really wants to point deeper than that, beyond the social utility of a self. And this comes back to the notion of virtue again, because the self that's created can either be pro-social, kind, compassionate, generous, tolerant, so forth and so on, or antisocial, unkind, greedy, filled with aversion and ill will, so forth and so on. That's the neuroplasticity part, and that's the emptiness or voidness part. Okay. Now I'm going to read the quote, and then we'll talk about this. Well, no, one more thing. The other thing I want to say about virtue and social wellness or social well-being. We live in a culture, consumer culture, that is built around convincing us to be a certain kind of person, depending on a variety of factors, gender and skin color and age and citizenship and ethnicity and all that kind of stuff. We need to see that as a construct that it can change. Because this is a culture that's going through a lot of change. It's very stressful. But it gives us an opportunity to understand at a deeper level how to manage this creative process that we call selfing and bring it to benefit, allow it to provide benefit in terms of our interpersonal relationships, what we're experiencing in this room, but on a larger cultural scale, how to be in the world. Here's the quote. Put it simply, in a moment of voidness, all the virtues are present. There's perfect mindfulness and self-awareness, sati sampajanya. Perfect sense of shame about doing evil, iri. Perfect fear of doing evil, otapa. Perfect patience and endurance, kanti. Perfect gentleness, saraccha. Perfect gratitude, katanu katiyedi. Katavedi, excuse me. And perfect honesty, satya. And in voidness, there is the knowledge and vision according to reality, yathabhuta jnanadasana. That is the cause for the fruition of the path and the attainment of nibbana. I come down to basics, saying that there must be mindfulness and self-awareness, shame about doing evil, fear of doing evil, patience, gentleness, gratitude, and honesty, because these are also Dhamma. They too can be a refuge for the world. Even with hiri and otapa alone, the aversion and shame towards doing evil and the fear of doing evil, the world would be tranquil with lasting peace. Nowadays, there seem to be many callous people who have no sense of fear or shame with regard to doing evil. Being that way, they're able to do improper things and insist on doing them continually. Even when they see that their actions will create disaster for the whole world, they persist. And so the world is being destroyed because it lacks even this small virtue. Off paper here. This was written in the early 1960s, by the way,
So
in
interesting.
Thailand. Or we may take an even humbler virtue, that of gratitude. Ketanu Katavedi. With just this one virtue, the world could be at peace. We must recognize that every person in the world is the benefactor of everyone else. Never mind people, even cats and dogs are benefactors of humanity. Even sparrows are. If we are aware of our debt of gratitude to these things, we will be unable to act in any way that harms or oppresses them. With the power of this single virtue of gratitude, we can help the world. It follows that those things that take the name of virtue, if they are real virtues, have an identical nature. Every one of them has the power to help the world. But if virtues are false, they become obstructive, a disordered mass of contradictions. When there is true virtue, one that is void of I or mine, all of the Dhammas and all of the Buddhas can be found in it. All things are present within that one mind, which is the true mind, the mind in its true state. On the other hand, the mind that is feverishly proliferating with I and mine is without virtue. In those moments, there is no mindfulness or self-awareness. The mind is in a rash, hasty state. There is no forethought and consideration, no restraint. There is ahiri and anuttapa, shamelessness, and no fear of doing evil. One is callous regarding evil actions, and one is without gratitude. The mind is so enveloped in darkness that one can do things that destroy the world. There's no use talking about the clear knowledge and vision of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and selflessness. All wholesome qualities are incomprehensible to a mind in such a lowly state. Thus, we must be aware of these two kinds of mind. Void of I and not void of I. We refer to the former as void and the latter as disturbed, busy. The mind undisturbed. Here, your common sense may say that nobody likes being disturbed. Everyone likes to be void in one way or another. Some people like the lazy voidness of not having to work. Everyone likes to be void of the annoyance of having noisy children bothering them. However, these types of voidnesses are external. They're not true voidness. Inner voidness, sunyata, means to be truly normal and natural, to have a mind that is not scattered, confused. Anyone who experienced this really appreciates it. If voidness develops to its greatest degree, which to be actually void of egoism, then it is nirvana. The disturbed mind is just the opposite. It is disturbed in every way, physically, mentally, and spiritually. It is totally confused, without the slightest peace or happiness. In sunyata is Dhamma, is Buddha, is the mind's original nature. In busyness, there is no Dhamma. And no Buddha. No matter how many times we shout and holler, to the Buddha I go for refuge, Buddham Sarvanam Gacchami. There's an aside. It's said often at the very beginning of a retreat or some kind of spiritual gathering in the Buddhist world. Back to the text. It is impossible for there to be Dhamma in the busy mind. For people whose minds are disturbed by I and mine, even if they take refuge in the Triple Gem, receive the precepts, offer alms, and make merit, there can be no true Buddha, Dhamma, or Sangha present. Everything becomes just a meaningless ritual. The true Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha abide in the void mind. Whenever the mind is void of I and mine, the Triple Gem is present right there. If it is void for only a while, that is temporary Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. If it is absolute voidness, that is real, an enduring Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. Please keep making the effort to void your minds of I and mine. Then the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha will be present regularly. Keep voiding the mind until the voidness is perfect, until it is absolute. We must take Dhamma, which is simultaneously the cure of the spiritual disease and the antibody which builds immunity. And we must put it into use in our mind so that there is no way for the disease to be born. So, just to kind of put a cap on it, I've talked before about how we live in a process that's afflicted with craving and clinging, and it creates distress and confusion, emotional upset, the absence of serenity, and confusion about how to be in the world and what to expect of the world, right? And I call that self-state conflict. So, with the application of neuroplasticity, in this concept of voidness, means you can change how you experience yourself. You can do that with training. And we call the virtues of kindness and compassion and integrity and so forth and so on, they become more and more integrated because of neuroplasticity into how you see yourself in the world. And that creates a platform that's stable and balanced and maximally manageable. Right? That's what we're talking about here. So you move from self-state conflict to what I call self-state integration, still operating in the world, still having an identity, but being able to navigate the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, to quote Shakespeare. More effectively, with more grace, less stress, more clarity, right? We can do that. So that's self-state integrity. And that's what this is talking about here in terms of mind that is free of shame. And free, shamelessness and recklessness. Those of you who are in the room can see the charts that are on the wall, the 52 mind conditioners, chittasikas. Shamelessness and recklessness are there. And so is the antithesis of shamelessness, which is a sense of respect for wisdom. The way it's shamelessness is described as indulging in thoughts and actions that would warrant compassion in the hearts and minds of the wise. They would notice that you were messing up and have compassion for you. So you just don't do that. And that's the antithesis to recklessness. Recklessness basically means I can keep doing the same nonsensical, unvirtuous thing over and over again, and somehow or other, this time I'll be immune. from the consequences. This time I'll get away with it. And we do that routinely, right? We can change that. That's what virtue is. And the whole notion of sunyata or neuroplasticity, that's explaining how we actually do it, but it requires training. So now, when you think about what I've been saying, let's talk about it. Let me get back to the Zoom screen here. Yes, Will.
Yeah, so thanks. This was very good. I read it a few times to make sure I understood everything. And, one question that kept coming back to me was the case of being a baby. Because when I was a baby, I had no ego. Even if I had craving and aversion, I had no idea of it. I wasn't aware of it. So, from your training as a psychologist and also, your journey in the path. How do you explain that? There's this question of when we're born, did we know everything already?
No.
Or do we, do we have to go through this path
Yes.
of our environment influencing us? And
Yes.
then we have to fight. So it's like we're born, we have this
No, we have to
potential.
let go of fighting.
Well, so I guess where I'm starting from is like when we come into the world, we come with a degree of innocence, and then we have no choice to grow. And in doing so, we accumulate all these things that compels us to see self-state integration, as you put it. So without trying to use like past future life, past life, how do you explain that to somebody who has the question of, were we born knowing everything, or do we have to learn to know?
So, when you were talking, well, what came to mind was a kind of Christian explanation for why babies are the way they are. It's called original sin. We're born sinful. All right, what does that mean? That puzzled me for a long time. My understanding of it has to do with Buddhist psychology, that we're hardwired for empathy. We are hardwired for the most part. The capacity to learn language, to learn how to tie our shoes, so forth and so on. That's part of the empathy process of mimicry. We watch somebody tie their shoes, or somebody tells us how to tie our shoes, and we learn how to do that. Okay, this is how the ego is created. My understanding of ego is not a noun kind of thing, it's a sorting process. We talk about my ego. There's the I and mine again, right? As if it's a thing. It's a sorting process. And what goes on is that a stimulus occurs in the environment, and based on prior experience, the mind interprets it and creates a relationship. There's the relationship that I identified as this is myself, and the other is this is my shoelace, right? So there's a relationship in terms of the process of tying the shoelace. Well, that's on a very simple level, but on a very complex level, we're talking about the conditioning that we're all subjected to in our families of origin and the culture that we grow up in. So that's how Buddhism understands what Christians would call original sin, except Buddhism calls it greed, hatred, and ignorance. We're hardwired for desire. We're hardwired for aversion. And we are not sufficiently trained to overcome the ignorance. And that's why in that quote, they're talking about mindfulness and wisdom, right? Being virtuous, being kind, being generous, having integrity, so forth and so on. So that's how that occurs. That's the transition from being an infant to being a child to being an adolescent to being a young adult to be an older adult, so forth and so on. To all go through all these different stages of development, part of which is physical, hormonal, and part of which is mental, cultural. And that's what we have to work with. So the ego is a sorting process. I mean, I'm speaking right now, sound is emanating out into the room. Your auditory process is activated and it starts through long-term potentiation, hooks up with your memory traces about what the sounds mean in relationship to the originator of the sound, which is me. Those of you who've known me for a long time, compared to people who've just met me, there's a different kind of process brought to bear. But the whole concept of emptiness and the realization of, oh yeah, I can change how I see myself here. I can change how I feel. I can change how I behave, is what the path is all about. Is that helpful?
Yeah, that actually leads to my next question.
Okay, and then
Is
we'll
that,
go to the next person.
yes, please. So, in this part, we're chasing the void state of mind, right? The mind that has no attachments and all these impurities, right?
We're choosing to let go of that which obscures the voidness that's already potentially available. I'm making that distinction because it seems like voidness is something you go get, right? And you train it or you build it or whatever. No, through the process of investigation, mindfulness, and wisdom, that which obscures that innate flexibility is more in awareness. That's an important distinction to make.
Is the void mind the default state of mind, or the self state negated mind the default state of mind?
The default state of the mind is distressed and confused because the mind only exists when a thought or a feeling is projected on it, like projector on a screen. So the mind doesn't exist without thoughts to be thought. So I mean, I'm not going to drift away from this whole notion of what emptiness is. That's my intention here. And so a lot of it is semantic. You and I are having a kind of semantic debate here about what does this mean? What does that mean? But I'm trying to use that as a means for really targeting in on what I want to emphasize tonight. I'm sorry that if I'm breaking your stride there.
You answered my question. It's just,
Okay.
I get it. Thank you.
Val?
Thank you for the explanation. For years, I tried to understand and I rejected the emptiness and I was adamant about it, against it. And for me, what clicked tonight is the link with what's that, origination?
Dependent origination.
Makes perfect sense. It
If you
makes
go
perfect
online
sense.
and you use the search terms contingent provisional emergence, that will take you to an article I wrote that's posted on, it's actually posted on the website too, about dependent origination. And I rename it.
See, because I never made this connection, because usually dependent origination, the examples are bicycle. If bicycle is not made by a single person, it's another man. Okay, that's not what a person is. But now when you talk about it in the context of a person, yes, that makes perfect sense in the context of the mind. Yeah, thank you.
It's all about the mind. See that that's something that's been bounced around for millennia in the mystical world, the world of meditation. is this consideration of how sorry, no, my mind just slipped on that. Can you say that again, please?
I was talking about the link between dependent origination and emptiness. And now I can understand it in this context. I could not understand it in the context of mind idea.
You have to use a simile. You have to use some kind of image. You used a bicycle.
Right. Well, not
The
mind,
classical one
not
is
mind.
chariot. When, you know, if you start disassembling a chariot, it becomes less and less recognizable as a
Yes.
chariot.
Never
But
come to
that,
the
but see,
same thing.
what that points to is the confusion that goes on between what the mind makes and what's actually going on out in the world. One of the suppositions in a lot of Buddhist psychology is that there is no, nothing is unique in and of itself. For example, I'm tapping my
No, I
laptop
get that. Yeah.
computer. It's not real, right? The whole notion of whether it's real or not is misunderstanding the situation. What the mind is what makes it real and makes it useful. Is it useful in order to improve spiritually, or is it useful to degrade spiritually? It's still an object, so to speak, but what makes it meaningful is what the mind puts to it. And so Buddhism, when Buddhism talks about, that's one of the reasons why emptiness is kind of a geographical consideration. It's like interstellar space is empty, quote unquote. It's a complete misunderstanding of what it is, of what sunyata is. Sunyata basically means is that everything in the mind is conditional.
That starts making sense. Putting this way makes perfect sense to find.
There's still room for the kind of genius that would make a laptop computer, right? But then how do we use it? And that's a really important question in terms of virtue. And I mentioned that earlier. And some of the quotes there, I mentioned it was in 1962 that these Dharma talks were given by Buddhadasa, that he was talking about corruption in the world and evildoers in the world. Of course, this is the beginning of what became the Vietnam War era, after World War, after the Korean War and World War II and so forth. So, I mean, that is prescient, I will say. He was talking about it, but it's really in our faces right now, isn't it? Power grabs and corruption and all that stuff. And how do we function in this kind of world? Through virtue, to be virtuous. I think that's one of the things that Mahatma Gandhi really manifested. And he basically was the inspiration for Dr. Martin Luther King in his efforts. Sharon?
Thinking more in terms of virtue, I'm getting lost in some of the other aspects, but emptiness one. But in terms of virtue, if we are aware of the wholesomeness of our thoughts, the wholesomeness of our speech, wholesomeness of our actions, I think pretty much we understand what is and what isn't right or wholesome. And yet, I sometimes reflect on. I have these pop-up memories of a dichotomy of like in our entertainment, and I'm just going to use this as an entertainment world. We have comedy based on people falling, people getting injured, people having tragic things happen, and
America's quote unquote funniest videos.
almost any kind of you know an injurious. I mean, it's not funny. And I found myself laughing, and this kind of rolls back in my memory and it pops up every now and then. when my mother was at her end of life stage, and she sat down and lost her balance and fell onto the hard bench. And I spontaneously laughed. And she spontaneously reacted like, that's not funny. And it wasn't, but why?
Well, I've given that a lot of thought as a psychotherapist. It's, I think, along the lines of, oh my God, that could have been me. I could be the person who looks like a fool. I could be the person who said the wrong thing. I think it's embarrassment. That's one of the reasons why slapstick comedy exists.
I, in my thinking about that as an example, and I mean, I'm very, there are other examples when I that pop up in a maybe in a long ago memory, but I wonder they could be that what you described, but I'm also wondering whether it's like a it wasn't funny, but I laughed, but maybe it was the tension of it. It's
That's
something as simple as tension, it's sort of like a yawn. Or like,
right.
you know, a release of,
Right.
because I was really like, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's empathy. There's an empathic process going on there. We're vibing off the other person's misfortune or foolishness. But I think part of it is a realization, you know, the empathy is not can be transformed or reorganized as compassion, or it can be just a burst of released energy, like a yawn, or that kind of outburst of laughter.
This discussion has kind of brought that to me in listening and thinking about it. And yet, entertainment is no longer entertainment. If I watch a movie, if I watch a, unless it's really skillful, or a program where people are insulting each other, people are cruel to each other, and then there's this, you know, audio track of people, of laughter, and people are responding with laughter to what, you know, and a lot of times it's interpersonal relationship.
So to put it in the context of greed, hatred, and ignorance, it could be, and once again, we're talking about empathy, it could be that there's an empathic response to someone else's foolishness. And the mind is confronted with an identity that, you know, a kind of a mirroring. That's what I meant when I said that, oh, that could be me. But instead, it's displaced into what a fool, how stupid could you be? And the laughter is just kind of an outburst of released energy. So, but this still pertains to the notion of what does it mean to be virtuous? You know, being laughing at someone else's misfortune is not virtuous. It's antisocial. It's not pro-social, and it's not. It does not support trust among people. So, yes, Val.
One of my best stories is about me falling while skiing, rolling down the hill, and injuring myself. And I find those very funny. And so it's got to be something to me. I don't find it antisocial. I still don't understand what it is, like you guys talked about it, but it makes very good stories. And they're
No,
about me. I'm laughing
you
at myself. Yeah.
can be amused by your and humble,
Right. And
right?
that's
So
what it is. Yeah.
that's it's still a release of energy, but it's not so much empathy has to be interactive. You can have an understanding of yourself as, well, that didn't work well,
Yeah.
or you can have an understanding of yourself as, oh my God, these people think I'm an idiot, right? Which at that point becomes antisocial because there's a loss of confidence that you're acceptable. But the whole thing is organized in terms of the topic for the evening, how to be mindfully aware of how the mind is making itself neuroplasticity, and whether that self-creating process is helpful or not in terms of your own well-being, your own ability to keep your balance in the midst of a complicated situation, and your interpersonal dynamics, which is where the empathy plays out.
Peter.
Yes, ma'am.
Marty has a question or a comment.
Thank you, Marty. Please go ahead.
Okay, unmute. I wanted to go back to what Will was asking, if I could. Is that okay?
Sure.
So, and you were talking about the baby thing. I always think in terms of, okay, we are mammals. We are animals. We are part of the animal kingdom. Our body is, we are not separate from nature. And so to me, it's like we can grow and become more like an animal, or we can grow and become more conscious, and we can become more empathetic, and we can become like it takes effort to move away from our biological nature into our spiritual nature. Is that not kind of the same thing?
Yes, it is. I've often said suggested that the development of spirituality, and I'm saying spirituality different from religions. Religions are institutions, they're organizations that have kind of political stuff going on. But spirituality, I think, is the leading edge of human evolution because of the characteristics of virtue. I often compare it to proto-humans who were just developing the capacity for language and could make sounds, and those sounds were understandable and informative, and it had made a tremendous change in human culture. It's how we became human, I think.
You know, I
Now,
see.
let me say, now we're at the stage where we've created a very complex world culture that is doing great damage to the ecology of
Yeah.
the planet. And so spirituality, I think the ability to understand how we're being conditioned by culture and making better choices is what's going to move evolution forward rather than creating another catastrophe like when that huge object hit the earth and wiped out the dinosaurs.
Well, I see animals that learn to be empathetic. I mean, I have dogs, and but I've seen animals that had show care. They go get people to help them do something because they have like a puppy or something, or a baby bird is in danger, or a leopard, or I mean, they seem to have more empathy sometimes than we do for each other, and people seem to celebrate that. So if animals can have evolved to have a sort of a consciousness about what's right and wrong, you would think that we could. So we seem to be going backwards. You know, I had a biology teacher one time say that devolution is faster than evolution, that things devolve faster than they evolve, and that's actually scientific.
Well, things are always changing. See,
Right.
one of the problems that we have in terms of craving and clinging is what's called reification, REIFICATION, which means that something becomes sacred. And it could be an idea. Democracy is reified. Wealth is reified. And enlightenment is reified. So it's made into an ideal, an object. And so then what happens with that is that we're either moving forward or we're moving back. No, there are just simply choices and the consequences of these choices. And all we can do with ourselves and interpersonally is manage those kinds of transactions, those interactions that we have organized around virtue. And hopefully that's going to move things forward, because the training that meditation provides allows us to do that. Now, there is another trend, which is ignorance, which is to be biased and be stuck in a particular view and not be willing and able to adapt because circumstances are changing. But your guiding principle with spirituality is that what guides your change is virtue. It's not selfishness. And I don't care what spiritual tradition you're talking about, that's what we're talking about, is that.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Alex?
So I love the idea of like neuroplasticity, kind of like essentially building yourself up, or the self, with the virtuous aspects and stuff. My question is, so in being in like in being in that voidness and understanding the emptiness and how things like depend on each other for meaning and such, the on the material world, like, okay, understood. Does that also apply to the conceptual world? Like the same emptiness, like our concept just of emptiness.
Oh, that's the basic, that's where it's most applicable.
Right. And so then my next question would be, is like, would that apply not to virtuosity itself? Like, are virtues
Absolutely.
not like defined by their opposite?
Absolutely.
Right. And so then.
Virtue just creates. Here's the way it's one of the similes that's used. Let's assume that dukkha, distress and confusion, is like a thorn in your foot. So there's the injury of the thorn, and then there's the mental construct around it, right? Now, with Buddhism, you take the concepts of virtue, mindfulness, wisdom, and so forth as thorns, and you dig out the other thorn, which is the concept of woe is me, I just stubbed my toe and it hurts, right? So then when you used that skillfully, you throw both thorns away. And what that means is the transition from self-state integrity to self-state liberation. The whole notion of virtue becomes so reinforced as a neural pathway, it creates a kind of stability of selfing process. And then you can go deeper into more and more sensitive areas and realize the ultimate truth about the fabrication of the self.
Are you kind of describing like an automatic, so like an automatic virtuosity that is not necessarily like something that you're doing intentionally? It's kind of like a byproduct of being in that voidness. Is that?
Yes. It's not doing it because you society says you should do it. It's done because it's what you're supposed to do.
Right. Yeah, because my next question was like, what do you do in face, like, once you, like, if you deconstruct, it's all empty, all concepts, like, that's like a lot of freedom. Like, yeah, what I guess
It's the
what you kind
ultimate
of answered
freedom.
it with, like, by saying you throw it both forms, you kind of throw it all the way.
It's the ultimate freedom.
Right.
Yes, ma'am.
So, how would you use mindfulness, say?
Say.
How would you use mindfulness to cultivate gratitude? I'm not deliberately saying, okay, I'm going to really work on gratitude today, so I'm going to be mindful. What I've discovered with my practice is that the more I apply mindfulness and investigation and right effort, three of the seven awakening factors, the more I can consciously train with those skills, the more grateful I feel.
It's byproduct in the
What?
byproduct, not
Yes.
the goal.
It's the consequence. It's the result of, it's not because I'm doing this because I want to be more grateful. It's just that as the mind is liberated from confusion, distress and confusion, I'm so grateful. And I'm not just grateful that I'm free from distress and confusion. I'm grateful because I get to walk with my dog. I'm grateful because, stay with me here, I know how to deal with my pain. In terms of using the two thorns, I can experience the physical discomfort of the pain and have a quality of kindness and balance and stability and non-reactivity in that experience in the mind. I've said this before. During one retreat many years ago, I had an episode of kidney stones, and I've had several of them in my life. But during this episode, I woke up with it and I realized, because I've had the experience before, oh, this is a kidney stone. Isn't that interesting? Body started to writhe in pain. But my mind was like, oh, how interesting. Look what a body does with a kidney stone episode. How interesting. And that I'm grateful for that. The gratitude comes with that, that I have that capacity to get through life with less stress and strain. Does that help?
Yeah.
Mitch?
I find developing more and more mindfulness to be revelatory. It just kind of reveals the world as it is beyond any kind of narrative training that I've experienced or that may be impacting me, so that, just being quietly observant, mindful, gratitude arises because you'll be able to see how things are in the world, and you realize your own circumstance, and then you can see others' circumstances, and there's a gratitude that just naturally just kind of deeply within just arises because you're not deluded by the me that we get so caught up in. We just get so full of ourselves. There is a, you know, that's the one thing that I've been kind of mulling over. There is selfhood, but we just take it so far. It's like we just get so full of ourselves, so narrowly focused on what we want, how we want it, how the way we see it is the right way, and others is the wrong way, that we don't have that quietude that allow us to see what really is going on.
Yeah, I mentioned the awakening factors. What happens when we're really mindful and clearly aware of the conditioning of the mind and not trapped by it? Joy occurs. And that's what I was describing. There was this quality of buoyancy and engaged, non-reactive interest when I was having this episode of kidney stones. That, to me, gratitude and joy are kind of commingled. And it also comes very much to awareness too when I'm generous. There's a quality of gratitude about the experience of letting go, in terms of material things, giving them to somebody, or the generosity of kindness and patience with another person. There's something I'm really grateful for about that generosity as well. So we're having a really good discussion, but I'm noticing we've been talking a long time. I believe that next week the topic is going to be a report.
No, I think that's the week after.
Week after. Yes, I'm going to be, I think it's going to be open Dharma questions next week. And then week after that, Leslie is on a 10-day mindfulness meditation retreat in Georgia, and I'm looking forward to hearing of her experience coming back from that. It's our custom to sit together momentarily, so let's do that for a brief interval. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well, and I hope that we're all safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.